Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Peter Phillips. Mickey Huff is taking the day off with his family. Today we will interview Dr. James Joseph Dean, a sociologist at Sonoma State University, who studies sexualities, gender, race, and inequalities. His recent book is entitled Straights: Heterosexuality in a Post-Closeted Culture. He addresses changes in heterosexual identity in America. We'll also be joined by two Project Censored interns from the College of Marin. Maya McHugh will interview Caitlin McCoy on contemporary LGBTQ issues. Stay tuned. We're the promise of a legacy, a spirit. We're honoring an anomaly to those who can't imagine a world without oppressive forces, slaving for almighty dollar bills. Since the Stonewall riots in 1969, the politics of sexual identity in America has drastically transformed. It's almost old news that recent generations of Americans have grown up in a culture more accepting of out lesbians and gay men. Seeing the proliferation of LGBTQ media representations and witness the attainment of a range of legal rights for same-sex couples. But the changes wrought by the so-called post-closeted culture have not just impacted the queer community. Heterosexuals are also in the midst of a sea of change on how their sexuality plays out in everyday life. Our guest today is James Joseph Dean. He's associate professor of sociology at Sonoma State University. He has a new book called Straights. Dean argues that heterosexuals can neither assume the invisibility of gays or lesbians, nor count on the assumption that their own heterosexuality will go unchallenged. The presumption that we are all heterosexual or that such thing as compulsory heterosexuality claims has pretty much vanished. So, James, welcome.
Thanks for having me on, Peter.
Well, I've had a chance to review your book. It's quite impressive. And it's out of now from NYU Press. What made you decide to write this book?
When I was in college, I was majoring in sociology and gender studies. And one of the books we were reading in gender studies was about The Social Construction of Whiteness, is a book by Ruth Frankenberg called White Women, Race Matters. You know, I was also reading about men and masculinity and masculinity studies. And so in thinking about wanting to do a major research project when I went to graduate school, I wanted to do something in sexuality studies that would be similar to The Social Construction of Whiteness and Whiteness Studies and Race, and similar to the study of men and masculinities and gender studies. And so I decided to do an interview-based project on the social construction of heterosexual identities and how we need to analyze the majority and the taken-for-granted category of straights and straightness.
You lay out a history of kind of understanding homosexuality, heterosexuality, and there was really 100 years ago, those categories weren't very, very obvious.
Mm-hmm.
And you write about how in the 1930s, heterosexuality became more important. Why was that?
So I think what's really interesting is that in part, the categories of heterosexuality and homosexuality started to circulate as subcultural groups started to emerge within major American cities and major European cities like Berlin, London, New York, Chicago, Philadelphia. So before, you know, women's sexuality had been reduced to reproduction, and men's sexuality, when it came to acts of sexual behavior, were really about whether or not they were taking, say, the active penetrator role. So as long as you did that, you could be seen as a normal in quotes, man in cities like New York, Chicago, Philadelphia from, you know, the 1890s to 1930s. But at the same time, you did have publicly visible gay, lesbian subcultures. The historian George Chauncey refers to feminine homosexual men as fairies at this time. But what happens is, as heterosexuality is coined and then takes on a life of its own, it starts to mean that normal men who think of themselves no longer as just gendered, but now as heterosexual, not just simply normal, they start to exclude same-sex contact. And similarly, fairies die out and gay becomes the category that homosexual men use. And that's supposed to also be not about their gender presentation, but rather just about who they're interested in having same-sex contact with. So it's sort of about the emergence of heterosexual, homosexual, and sexual identity categories and the subsiding of gender as the predominant category for how sexual relations were organized in the U.S. at that time.
And you wrote how historically in the Victorian era that love and sexuality were really kind of separate things.
Right. So, I mean, I think what a lot of Americans don't realize is that romantic love, as we think of it today, has a short history. So in the 1800s, in the Victorian era, love was spiritual, love wasn't sexualized, and sex was for procreation. And now we think of sex, at least at times, as an expression of love. And we also think of love as being expressed through sexual relations. So that predominant notion is really a, you know, last 100 years notion that Americans have taken up. And that changes, of course, over the last 50, 75 years as well.
That's interesting to study this historically and to be able to understand how cultures change, the social construction of identity can change and is in fact changing. Now, your book, Straights, you've interviewed 60 individuals, 30 men, both black and white, and women, both black and white. These were extensive interviews about their lives and their identity and their sexual orientations. What did you find out?
The main idea behind studying straight identity I found was that, you know, and I know this from personal experience being a gay man myself, is that the way that homophobia changes after high school, you know, and we have studies like C.J. Pascoe's Dude, You're a Fag, and the use of the fag discourse is so common among high school boys, both against gay boys as well as against other straight identified boys. But after high school, I think haven't paid attention to homophobia in the same way. And also, we haven't been paying attention to all the ways that straight people are not homophobic and also against homophobia. And so what I found is that straight individuals, and I interviewed both homophobic ones as well as really strong activist allies to the gay community. And among the homophobic straight individuals, what I found is that they avoided acquaintances or friendships with gay lesbian people. They avoided gay lesbian spaces, a gay neighborhood, a gay bar, gay pride parade events. And they also, a lot of straight men were hyper-conscious about not wearing things that they viewed as, quote, gay or feminine. But on the flip side, I found that there's a lot of men and women, a lot of straight men and women who do have gay lesbian friends, will go to gay pride events, but they don't want to be mistaken as gay or lesbian themselves. And they're quick to let people know they're straight, even though they have these real, you know, strong friendships or sense of equality. I mean, more women than men were willing to, at times, give up the sense of straight privilege. That is, they didn't always have to claim a straight identity if someone thought they might be non-straight. So about 7 of the 30 women I interviewed would do that, and about 4 of the 30 men I interviewed would do that. So that is, they could go to gay bars with, you know, gay straight friends and not disclose that, oh, I'm straight. Don't mistake me for being gay, right? So those kind of contexts, I thought, really show how some straight people are really strong allies, even activists, for the gay community today.
Certainly, I remember sociologists who would be lecturing on sexual identity and talk strongly in support of homosexual freedoms and that sort of thing, but often frame it, and this is like 20 years ago, frame it in that, well, I'm straight. You know, so people weren't confused. They didn't actually have to say that. And
right.
So you're saying that that's still there to a certain extent?
Exactly. That's still there. I mean, you know, most of the men, you know, and most of the women I talk to, I think a lot of them are very gay friendly. A lot of them support gay rights, whether it's same-sex marriage and so on. But a lot of straight individuals, men and women, want to be defined by their straight status. So straight men, for example, if they went to a gay bar, a lot of them would bring their girlfriend, their wife, and they use their wife or girlfriend as a proxy to signal, oh, I'm straight, don't confuse me. And, you know, more women, more of the straight women I talked to didn't need to do that. But I think, you know, that's part of the gender differences.
Or they would be wearing a wedding ring.
Right, they'd wear a wedding ring.
But rings now, in terms of gay marriage, are present. So that signal isn't as strong as it used to be.
Exactly. So that's interesting, right? I mean, if gays and lesbians can get married, then saying I have a wife or a husband can't be read as, oh, I have a straight wife or a straight husband. And similarly, wedding rings can't be used as clearly heterosexual symbols. So I think, you know, gay lesbian marriage has a lot of really interesting everyday implications.
For straight people.
For straight people and for gay people. You know, when gay marriage was illegal in California, a lot of my gay friends in L.A. would wear a wedding ring, but on the opposite finger that it was normally worn on, in order to sort of signal how they wore, wanting to be included but still excluded. So, I mean, now that it's legal in California, it's probably changed again. But I think there are all these sort of many ways in which gay communities are responding and straights, you know, also thus respond in kind.
Use the terminology post-closeted culture. When did that really happen, and what's the history to that?
The way that I divided the history was to say that along with historians, sociologists, and legal scholars, we can say that there's been an out generation of gay men and lesbians, as well as bisexual and transgendered people, since post-Stonewall, so in the 60s and then 70s. And then the other thing that historians, sociologists have been noting is that in the 1990s, there was sort of a huge proliferation in mass media representations. And, you know, that's really different from, you know, when I was growing up and watching television in high school in the early 1990s, there was only The Real World. But since that time, we've seen Glee, Modern Family, we've seen blockbuster movies, we've seen Oscar-nominated movies, whether that be Brokeback Mountain, whether it be Philadelphia. So on one hand, we have all these mass media changes, and then on the other hand, you have a lot of rights at the state, county, and, you know, federal level where gay and lesbian couples are allowed to adopt. Gay and lesbian couples were given domestic partner benefits, and so on and so forth. So I think Stonewall signals the sort of first social movement critique of heterosexual homophobia. And the 1990s are about, I think, how a post-closeted culture of LGBT people and representations are entrenched across the media landscape and also entrenched in urban centers, small cities, so on and so forth. So, you know, that's not to say that a closet pattern doesn't persist, but if the closet persists and people are still leading double lives, it's also in the context of how a post-closet culture exists alongside that. When I teach this to my students, I say it's like having today marriages right alongside with cohabitation. We have both. Both are persisting. So I think of it as a complicated world in the U.S. today.
We're going to move into some of the racial differences, but we'll take a short musical break right at this point.
Okay, thanks.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Peter Phillips. I'm in studio today with James Joseph Dean. He's the author of the book Straits. He's a professor, associate professor of sexualities and identity at Sonoma State University. And we're talking about his new book, Straits, where he interviewed 60 people in terms of the transitions that are occurring in terms of sexual identity in America today. So, James, what kind of gender differences did you find between black and white straight men and women?
So the gender differences I found is that, you know, even though I think a lot of homophobic straight men use boundaries of social distance, trying to avoid gay people, gay symbols, gay spaces, the homophobic straight women I interviewed didn't really use social distance as much as disparage gay lesbian relationships or gay and lesbian marriages. So that is, they had gay acquaintances or gay family members who they socialized with but did not approve of. And they didn't approve of them because they might have been strongly religious individuals, because they thought of it as culturally deviant and wrong. And so that was a difference. I think the gender differences among the straight men versus the straight women who were gay friendly and really, you know, strong allies to the LGBTQ community. The thing that I found among those ally straight women versus the straight men is that they talked to me about their own same-sex behaviors and their own same-sex encounters with other women. And there's a concept called sexual fluidity being used by the psychologist Lisa Diamond, and it refers to how people can have sexual behaviors and encounters and desires that are not based on the person, but really based on the situation. And so women have been found to be more sexually fluid than men. And I found that among the straight women I interviewed as opposed to the straight men. In part, I think these straight women told me about their interest in dating women, their fantasies of women, women that they had had sexual encounters with, as a way in which to show how they were such strong allies to the queer community. And straight men that I interviewed, the strongest allies among the straight men, they didn't do that. So that was really interesting to me.
So that was a real difference between men and women.
Oh, definitely.
That are straight.
Yeah. I mean, 10 out of 30 women talked about that with me. And 7 of those 10 were the strongest allies. Like, you know, if they had a bar restaurant, they had gay pride events in their bar restaurant. And they had talked about dating women or wanting to date women, fantasies of women, women they had dated, and those kinds of things, even though they identified as straight.
So if they identified as straight, there was still the possibility of sort of fluid relationships in terms not only with how they thought about things, but in perspective in their lives.
Yeah, exactly. And I think they were telling me those things to show me how they didn't have any shame around homosexuality or homosexual contact. And they, you know, many of them lived their lives with their gay lesbian friends, socializing, since I did my study on the East Coast, in, you know, gay resort towns like Provincetown, Massachusetts, and so on.
Certainly. So for men, though, even if they're anti-homophobic and maybe even speak out about that, you're finding less of the term, the use idea of fluid, and more of a strict heterosexual identity. Is that
right? So I think, you know, one of the ways that straight men still are under more pressure is that they're supposed to exclude same-sex contact. That's what being straight means. It means that you only have heterosexual desires as a straight man. And I think that norm is in some cases, or in many cases, stronger for straight men than women.
What kind of gender differences did you find between black and white straight men and women?
The gender differences between black and white straight men and women, I would say that at least among the homophobic individuals, black straight women were more likely to invoke religious reasons for why they were against gay relationships, same-sex marriage. So some black straight men did too as well. And it's true in the U.S. that blacks are on average more religious, have stronger religiosity than whites. And I found that to be a real strong rationale among black straight women who were variably homophobic. I think the other part of the racial differences amongst the black straight men and the black straight women, this is how they're similar, is that since they had experiences of racial prejudice, both black straight men and black straight women would link their experience of racism to lesbians and gays' experiences of homophobia. And that wasn't something that white straight men and women did. So they could understand prejudice through their own experiences of prejudice, and hence why they would be against homophobic prejudice just like they would be against racial prejudice.
The book is Straits, Heterosexuality in a Post-Closeted Culture by James Joseph Dean from NYU Press. And how do you see this continuing to change?
I've been teaching this book to my class, and one of the other gender differences that I write about in the book is metrosexuality among men. And so it was fun to talk with my students about that, because one of the kinds of things that's circulating in the Bay Area and across the U.S. is sort of hipster culture and hipster masculinities. And one of the takes on hipster masculinity is that it's less defensive. And so, you know, hipster masculinity could be skinny jeans, flat Tom brand-like shoes. My students mentioned guys who are wearing their hair in a bun and those kinds of things. So I think that to the extent that men, gay and straight, are trying on less rigidly traditional or less conventional masculine presentations, you can see more feminine or more supposedly gay styles among straight men. You know, metrosexuality is probably best seen through someone like David Beckham, who does all the advertising for H&M underwear and so on. But I think you can see it in hip-hop culture with artists like Kanye West, who wears kilts in concert, as well as, you know, sort of avant-garde, long blouse-like shirts and things. So I think that's something that will continue to persist.
I did come across one article about men's trends, and it was entitled Retrosexual Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
So it was men wearing, you know, kind of going back to styles that were very masculine.
Right. I mean, on one hand, you know, there's this sort of thing about the lumber sexual, and there's been a little bit of writing about it. So guys who grow beards and wear flannel. I mean, I think that what's interesting is how gender presentation for men and women, but, you know, for men in particular, is really this side of sexual identity politics. And what's interesting is that, you know, a lot of gay men, a lot of lesbian women are very gender conventional. And if that's the case, straight men and women who are gender conventional aren't signaling that they're necessarily straight by being conventional as well. And so on one hand, I think there's a loosening of gender presentation. And on the other hand, I think that there's a tightening and a defensiveness and anxiety about gender for straights and gays across the board.
You use the term compulsory heterosexuality, somewhat historically, but also to a certain extent contemporary. Well, what do you mean by that?
So I took the term from Adrian Rich, and Adrian Rich used it to talk about the norm of heterosexuality amongst women, particularly lesbian women. I think that compulsory heterosexuality is declining, and in part its decline comes from the fact that at least in everyday life, there are a lot of avenues for people to explore a non-straight identity. And if that's the case, that there's a lot of same-sex openness. There's a lot of same-sex contact. On the other hand, sure, that might not be the case for our social institutions to the same extent, but there is still also a lot of lesbian and gay participation in the workplace and in religious institutions and in the media. And so I think that across the board, while the norm of heterosexuality remains dominant, it can't be seen as compulsory in the same way as it was seen in the 70s and 80s when Adrian Rich was writing.
Do you think the impact of AIDS in the 80s was influential in sexual identity?
Sure, of course. I mean, I think in some ways the fact that we can manage HIV, AIDS in a way that people are living longer lives, healthier lives, and so on and so forth, I think that change in the way in which the disease is managed nowadays has allowed a lot of straight people to feel comfortable socializing in gay spaces and in ways that they never would have felt before. Mm-hmm. So I think straight people can go to the Castro, they can go to West Hollywood in a less anxious way because of how HIV/AIDS has shifted so.
We're going to take a short break, and then we'll be moving to hear from our students from College of Marin talking about issues that are going on there.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Peter Phillips. We're talking today about LGBTQ issues. And we have two students from the College of Marin joining us. They're both students of Susan Rahman. We have Maya McHugh, who is a Project Censored intern, and she will be interviewing Caitlin McCoy on contemporary LGBTQ issues. So welcome.
Thank you, Peter. So, Caitlin, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
So, I am born and raised in Oakland. I grew up here, and I have spent the majority of my entire life here. I never particularly identified as straight. I identified as bisexual very early, in my mid to late teens. And fortunately for me, my mother was very understanding. The rest of my family, it took them a little longer to kind of come around, but they only found out a few years ago.
Did you want to tell us a little bit more about your family and how they affected you and being a part of this community?
Well, my mother has always been incredibly supportive. She was an Oakland Unified School District educator for many years, longer than I have been alive. And she never gave me the impression that anything I wanted to do or anything I wanted to be was going to be a problem for her. That's not the way that she approached teaching, and it's definitely not the way that she approached parenting. The rest of my family have been very supportive once they kind of wrapped their head around the idea of me being queer, because I changed from bisexual to queer some years ago, because I felt that that was a better term for how I feel about my identity.
Did you want to tell our listeners, why did you change from bisexual to queer? Like, what about that identification makes you more comfortable?
The issue that I had with bisexuality was that it seemed to be very limited in its definition as far as who you were able to say that you were attracted to. If I say that I'm only attracted to men or women, then what about people who they themselves do not particularly identify as either of those? And I strongly disliked, and still dislike to this point, the way that bisexual people are kind of invalidated as far as their own gender particularities and what they're into. Even in the media, there's still this kind of idea of, well, you're fence sitters. And I decided to distance myself from that term and to be more inclusive in my own life and in how I define myself.
So speaking of the media, talk more about that. What about the media has made you realize that this coverage about these people is being totally objectified?
Well, one of the huge issues in the media right now is definitely gay rights, which is something that I feel is very important. But the problem with the mainstream media and gay rights is they treat it as if it is the great umbrella that will usher in all rights for all people at this point. And that's really not realistic, and it's not fair to all the people who lose their jobs, lose their housing, lose family support based on their presentation, based on their gender identity, based on their sexual identity. The ability for people to get married and for that marriage to be recognized by the government is incredibly important, but it is not the only thing, and it shouldn't be treated like the most important and only thing.
What other societal movements do you think need to be made aside from gay marriage being legalized in California?
I think that we need to be more aware of violence that is perpetrated against people within our community. There have been numerous deaths of trans women of color this year. The mainstream media has been very neglectful in reporting on these deaths. And I feel that we need to come together more as a community to protect people who are being attacked literally for their gender and for their gender presentation. And I feel that that in and of itself is definitely as important as gay marriage.
So what activism can people of the community in the Bay Area, what can they do to help the LGBTQP community?
Well, here in Oakland, there is the Pacific Center, which is a great nonprofit that works towards LGBTQP young people, providing them services and providing them resources. I think that the most important thing is to learn, to know what's happening to our community, to know what's happening to people like us, not just in the Bay Area, but across the state, across the country, across the world. I also believe that you know, getting out there, spending your time volunteering, be it with youth, be it with elders, be it with whomever, creating that sort of bond with other people that you may not otherwise encounter who are like you or even who may not be, is incredibly important just for enriching ourselves as human beings and to make ourselves better at being able to help others and help ourselves.
Thank you, Kaylin. Do you believe that there's a gender divide in sort of this acceptance of the LGBT community? You were saying previous that your family, not pertaining to your mother, but maybe older generations like your grandparents, how do you think they feel about this this ever-changing world that we are coming into?
I honestly think that for a lot of people, it's just flat out confusing. It's completely different from anything that they were made aware of growing up, unless their family circumstances varied from what was considered the norm. But being confused or having questions about what it means is not necessarily a bad thing, but making snap judgments is definitely where the problem comes in, or deciding that something is unnatural or unhealthy, or simply not listening to someone when they are trying to tell you, express to you what their identity is.
Do you think the media has an effect on that, of what people think is right or wrong or odd?
I think that the media has definitely had a very large focus on white cis male gay men as far as being sort of the shining beacon of the LGBT community, and that's not really an accurate representation. While, of course, they are important because they are a part of this community, it's not really fair to put people on a pedestal that marks them as being the ideal. So, you know, for a lot of people in the LGBTQ community, to get married and have kids and live what's kind of the heteronormative lifestyle is not what they're aiming for. And yet that is what the media portrays, what we are striving to be, even though, you know, marriage equality is still a huge issue. It's not necessarily a blanket issue for everyone.
Thank you, Kaylin. Do you believe that being in school, being in college, it makes understanding and being aware of these issues in the LGBT community more feasible to understand as opposed to being in the real world?
I don't think that academia negates real world experience. I feel that real world experience is incredibly, incredibly important. And we can't just say that because someone sat in a classroom for hours on end that they have a better sense than someone who has had real world experience for hours on end. But I do feel that academia gives us a really great framework for how to approach these things, how to discourse about them with others who may not be willing to discourse in a polite manner. It gives us a better framework for how to present information to others who would not seek this information out for themselves and who may not wish to hear this information at all. But as far as one trumping the other, real-world experience needs to be recognized as important. What happens to people in their daily lives is not necessarily going to be less important than what someone reads about in a textbook.
Thank you again, Kaylin. Is there anything else you'd like our listeners to know?
I just encourage everyone who's listening to, you know, get out there, become involved, donate your time, put some energy in there, make new connections with people that you would not make connections with otherwise because they're not in your home, they're not in your church, they're not in your job. Just be more present in the world that you're living in. You know, spend a little more time doing something that helps others. I think that would definitely be something I would want people to do.
Thank you so much, Kaylin, for your time.
Maya, thanks for the interview. And Kaylin, we're glad you're here. Now, you're going to stay with us. We're going to take a short musical break, and we're going to come back and bring James back into the conversation and really talk about where we are today with these issues. Well, welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Peter Phillips. In studio today, we have James Joseph Dean, author of the book Straits, Heterosexuality in a Post-Closeted Culture. Also, we have two students from the College of Marin, Maya McHugh and Caitlin McCoy. They're both Project Censored interns, and we welcome you back. James, let's come back to you. You just heard Caitlin talking about some of her experiences. Do you have some commentary?
No, I think that LGBTQ life in the Bay Area is really vibrant, really diverse. I think that just like we're starting to see issues around transgender representation more in the media, we have those issues in everyday life. And, I guess some of the sociological research in responding to questions around how trans men and trans women are represented is that it seems to be the case that trans women are, at least in media reports, often viewed as tricking straight men or gender conventional straight men. People use the term cisgender to talk about a link between those who were born male and identify in their social lives as masculine men. So I think that in that case, a lot of trans women are really under the brunt of people, cisgender men, feeling that they're tricking them by homosexuality. And that's a huge issue regarding gender expression, gender presentation. I think when I talk about it with my friends, we'll watch the show Looking on HBO. And one of the questions that comes up is that, you know, is there an LGBTQ community that's united? Or is it just so splintered, so diverse, so fractured that it's hard to talk about a community, so we'd have to talk about multiple communities and those kinds of things? So I think those are the kinds of thoughts that come to mind.
Could we talk about a single community that's made up of everyone with a comfortableness that allows for free expression? Is that sort of like where we could go culturally?
You think about, say, gay pride and how there's multiple marches, there's multiple celebrations. So there's the Dyke March, there's the Trans March, then there's the major Pride Parade event. I think that Pride sort of shows how the community tries to come together, and simultaneously it also shows how there's multiple voices wanting to be represented and recognized for good reasons, because issues can overlap, but simultaneously issues can be different within the queer community at large.
Caitlin, what's your view on gay marriage? Would you like to have someday have a single partner?
I think that would be wonderful. Personally, my current issue with gay marriage is not with the concept itself, but with media representation of what it means for gay marriage, what it means for LGBTQ people to have gay marriage available to them, and how it's touted as something that makes it so that there are no other issues that require media attention or evaluation. That's my primary issue with it. Personally, I would love to get married. I would love to throw a party over a relationship. I mean, that just sounds amazing.
I think most people, you know, desire personal relationships in their lives in some capacity, whether that means marriage or not. It's certainly an option that it's very personal. It's really important to a whole lot of people. So not having the restrictions of cultural restrictions, compulsory heterosexuality and the tradition there and those identities seems like are moving in a more fluid direction. James, I want to bring in and ask about power inequality and even politics in these issues on a more macro scale. That's, you know, I'm a political sociologist. So what role does identity play in politics today?
Well, I mean, I think identity continues to weigh heavily across the board. I mean, for example, take Barack Obama and his last election. I think according to the press, 95% of gays and lesbians voted for Barack Obama. So obviously he's carrying the gay lesbian community. And I think you've seen Obama wanting to link black civil rights, second wave feminism, and Stonewall, right? You hear him say those kinds of things in his inaugural speech. And so I think on one level, you know, really since Clinton, the LGBT movement has been behind the Democratic candidate. So that's been a trend since the 90s. I think that when we're talking about larger issues, we're also talking about sexual orientation, non-discrimination. We're talking about protecting gender presentation and expression. And sometimes I think with the human rights campaign and so on, transgender people have been left out. And so there's a lot of divisions around that, and there's a lot of debate around that, and there's a lot of anger and unfairness around that. And that makes a lot of sense. I think there's a lot of struggles happening at the level of law and macro politics that are playing out in important ways.
Obama, for the first 6 years, did not come out in support of gay marriage.
Sure.
And just recently did, even though he had told his staff he was in support of it. So there was that idea of being reelected. I think they must have viewed that and that it would hurt them.
Right. So, I mean, that's fascinating, right? I mean, you see how Democrats play politics with gay issues, right? And you saw both Obama and Hillary Clinton when she was running for the Democrat ticket. Both of them basically had the same position. So what that tells me is that Democrats are very much playing sort of political football with gay rights, same-sex marriage, and so on. And I guess on that level, they feel really disingenuous, right? When you hear things like both Obama and Clinton supported same-sex marriage personally, but they're not supporting it politically, it feels really disingenuous and disheartening.
Kaylin, do you have any commentary on what James Dean is explaining about the LGBT community in politics?
Well, I definitely feel that with the Republican push to identify, quote-unquote, what I remember San Francisco politics was a big buzzword a couple of years ago, as being sort of against the ideal American family and what the American family should stand for, then of course, given our two-party system, the LGBT community is going to side with the people who are not telling them that they are destroying families by existing and not even really doing anything against those families. I have my issues with the two-party system to begin with, so that's a totally different conversation. But I definitely agree that it does seem very disingenuous when politician will say, you know, in my personal life, I support these people and I support what they're doing and I support what they're fighting for. But as a political platform, it's a little too risky for me to say that right now. And it makes people feel as if they are literally a political token to be won. And that's not what anyone wishes to be felt like. Everyone wishes to be recognized as a human being with needs that need to be met. And to be limited down to just a political playing piece that is only brought out when it is most useful or can be the least damaging is honestly completely undermining the LGBT community.
You're listening to the voice of Maya McHugh and Kaitlyn McCoy, both students from the College of Marin. It's great to have you here with us today. And James Dean. He's the author of the book, Straits, Heterosexuality in a Post-Closeted Society. So the impacts of the transformation of sexual identity, partly because of the post-closeted nature of homosexuality, is impacting literally everybody. And so one of the premier institutions in school, certainly in high schools, historically, that was just honoring heterosexuality and marriage was the prom night.
Mm-hmm.
And we now have multiple cases where high schools are electing lesbian or gay king and queen proms. So that kind of transformation seems to be happening, but there's still resistance. And what kinds of resistances do you think we're having that continue to this day? And certainly resistance in different parts of the country.
Right, sure. You know, I think there's a lot of different kinds of resistances. I think Bernadette Barton wrote a really important book called Pray the Gay Away, The Extraordinary Lives of Bible Belt Gays and Lesbians, and she focused her research on Kentucky and Mississippi and Texas. And she shows that the strong Christian fundamentalist ideology of people in the Bible Belt creates a very toxic closet environment. And although she thinks it's peaked, it's much different than the Bay Area and the Northeast and the West Coast. So I think resistances are still happening on the level of Christian fundamentalism. I think resistances are happening on the level of notions of deviance or sinfulness, those kinds of things. I think that you have both, like you're saying, the transformation of the prom, and at the same time, resistances of various kinds. So I think it's interesting to try to chart both at the same time.
Certainly the refusal of the Catholic Church to accept women as priests. We did make that transition to altar girls a couple decades ago, but even that, there's been strong resistance. So it belies that there are very strong institutions that continue to resist these kinds of changes in identity. But that doesn't stop people from rethinking who they are.
Sure. I mean, you know, what I think is fascinating maybe about the media sphere is that one can watch a show like RuPaul's Drag Race, or one can watch a show like Transparent on Amazon, or, you know, Glee and Modern Family. And those shows are really rewarding for a lot of different reasons. I think part of it is, say, for example, the racial gender diversity on RuPaul's Drag Race. And I think Glee is about the representation of youth in high school. And so sometimes it feels as if our cultural sphere of media representations is ahead of our political sphere of legal rights.
Maya and Caitlin, how do you feel about the media and it portrays these issues?
I think that the representation that we currently see in television shows is fantastic. And I, of course, it always has room for improvement. It's definitely a very different picture than what the media portrays as far as news media and political news. But there's always that room for critique, and there's always that room for improvement, I feel. As long as shows become known for having these key characters that represent people, it needs to become a little more sort of all-encompassing. It shouldn't just be a handful of shows that have this great diversity of race and gender identification. It needs to be the majority, if not all shows, because you're talking about people who exist in every sphere of daily life, not just in these sort of narrow little pockets of a family who lives in California, you know?
I definitely agree with what Caitlin is saying. I definitely think that these shows are a push in the right direction, but there is a lot of growth that that needs to happen, and it'll be an exciting time to see what the future will hold for the media and what they can project towards the LGBTQ community.
I think that's true. You know, I think, you know, when I was in high school, the only show I remember with a gay character was The Real World, right? And The Real World was on MTV, and it started the whole trend around reality television. Now we just keep seeing shows grow and grow, and that's really exciting to see the sort of complicated portrayals that are on television. I think on that level, you know, the media landscape is really exciting, maybe much more exciting than, say, our political news or our nightly news. So that's encouraging to me.
And what about the trend in terms of, it's 20 years now for the use of the term Metro Male. Is there a new term coming forward that's more descriptive of the commonality of sexuality or the acceptance of sexuality across the board?
I think the reason why I used the term and why I asked straight men about the term is that it was a way to tap into the sexual identity politics around straight masculinity. And so I'm sure there'll be new terms to look into, whether it's, you know, lesbian until graduation, lug, or I'm heteroflexible, and so on and so forth. I think terms are useful to the extent that we use them to get into the gender sexual identity politics behind them. And sure, I'm sure new terms will come about because that's how society shifts, changes, grows, sort of oscillates back and forth.
Well, the New York Times in 2002 was kind of allowed for the gay unions to be listed in the marriage page. And except, well, they were called civil unions. Now they're called celebrations, weddings and celebrations. And civil unions historically were seen as something less than a full marriage. Mm-hmm. And legally as well. So we're moving closer to the full marriage rights, I think, for gay and lesbian people. All right, well, looks like we're out of time today. James Dean, the book is Straight, Heterosexuality, and Post-Closeted Culture from NYU Press. Certainly thank you to Maya McHugh and Caitlin McCoy for being our guests today from College of Marin. You're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. Special thanks to our producer, Anthony Fest. And Lucretia Burton is on the controls today. The Project Censored Show airs on 21 stations around the U.S. Archives can be found at projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook and stay tuned.
Political ties, habitual lies, alibis, disguise, another guise, democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burn bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the prisons and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, and the ties for the master thief. Divine conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that.